Thank you for joining the Unionate Egoist podcast. This is Standalone, SA-1029, a journal of egoism.
In my breast lies a treasure chest, a world that only I can.
In this episode, I will be reading from three different writers that are important to the Union of Egoists project. Two of them, Benjamin D. Cassiers and Sidney E. Parker, are part of the Core Project, but Volturine de Clare certainly plays into the history of egoism and individualist anarchism, of which there is a significant overlap.
Deep in my mind, deep in the depths of my ego, deep in my breast lies a treasure chest.
The first piece I will be reading is titled Hate, by Benjamin D. Cassiers. Philosophic and poetical gentility has prated for thousands of years of the creative and transforming power of love. I write something of the creative and transfiguring power of hate, of the eternity of hate, the morality of hate, the rejuvenating power of hate, the cosmic, social, and artistic necessity for hate, the splendor and sublimity of hate. Repulsion, hatred, opposition, room for me or thou diest, are the conditions of individuality. Universal love would ensure universal catalepsy. Passion creates, not love. The spark is struck off at the moment of impact. All movement is conditioned in hate. All so-called progress, which is merely motion lapsing from ironic goal to ironic goal, is the revolt of the present against the past. Eternal insurrection, challenge, hatred, and battle are the conditions of the survival of anything. Hate, dissatisfaction, discontent, contempt are the sacred fires that must be forever kept burning. What man dislikes shall be his god. What man hates shall be his golden cane brand. The mystical blasphemers, the upsetters, the deniers, the sappers, those who seek to lay the rotten rookeries of cosmic and earthly complacency in the dust, it is they who are the holy ghosts of our time, our guardians, the night watch of those who love and sleep. Prometheus, gnawed by a majestic hate, still parleys with Jove, and Lucifer, now as forever, still hurls his imprecations from his earth hell and pits his mystic seeds of black against the milk-white geldings of the Lord of Incense. In nature, hate and murder are conditions of survival. All beauty is the record of hate. Forms, elements, and worlds flush space, appealing to the contemplative aesthetic sense merely as carven images of beauty. But to the clairvoyant intellect, they are the painted records of an everlasting strife, the gonfalons of triumph raised above the cosmic shambles, the jubilees of hate triumphant. This opposition, hatred, strife, and demonic impulse to arise into being and maintain a foothold there at any cost is a commonplace of existence, but not a commonplace in human apprehension. To live and to pray or to hate. The Hindu says all life is guilt. All feasts celebrate the death of something. They are the gambles of the peoples on corpses, the high wassail of hate, the gratulations of survival. The Persian invocation says, "Give me this day an enemy." An enemy helps me to create, drives me to my wits' ends, distends my ego, and puts a thousand eyes in my brain. An enemy's eye cast on me in hate has fructifying power. Self rushes to the center of gravity. Instinct and intellect arise, armed cap-a-pie. From within the penetralia of the soul, there issues the primitive being, aerialed in his acrid aversions. Hate is ethical. Hate destroys trammels. It is the moral passion that burns up codes, parchments, and flays oleaginous optimism that pins paper roses in the hair of the lords of things as they are. Schopenhauer and Nietzsche and Strindberg roweled the dugs of the arch stupidity that litters us and the worlds we expire on like a field woman accouches her burden. Moral indignation, which is the name moralists give to hate, is a barometer of mental and spiritual life. Each is known by his aversions, by the things he seeks to destroy. They who hate life are greater than life. They who love life are stillborn. They are ravished only by sex and kitchen scents. The life of the individual is like the life of a beast of prey. The totality of each man's movements from the cradle to the grave, if they could be put into a design, into a kind of composite photograph, would resemble the circular, attentive movement of an animal about its prey. There is the thing the will seeks to pounce on and make its own, and we circle around it for years sometimes, drawing closer and closer, crushing with paw of egotism all that gets into our way. All great literature is rooted somewhere in an ideal hatred and a recognition of the eternal qui vive of man, the perception that man is greater in his overcomings than in his resignations. The revealer must be a good hater. He moves the world because the lever of intellectual perspective rests on the fulcrum of aversion. The second piece I will be reading is called Philosophic Spleen by Benjamin D. Cassiers. I will up and wander, swim and fancy free in this big world that's inside me. When we think of philosophers, we think of heads. Heads magical with dreams, heads poisoned with venom, heads that hold the secret of serenity, heads that are frenzied with the absolute, heads ironic, heads lascivious, heads anarchic, sad heads that carry about in them withered worlds and the parched and yellowed skins of their youthful ideals. Kant, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, Spinoza were the sensual hermits. Philosophy is the lamentation of intellectual voluptuaries, the recessional of renunciants, the triumphant largo of personal defeat. The thoughts of philosophers are their paramours. They weave their ecstasies of the incorporate. They have taken the infinite for concubine. Men who write out philosophies differ in no respect from women who keep secret diaries, for philosophy is nothing more than the diary of a bias, the autobiography of a private weakness. The beginning of intolerance is in a love of truth, which is the intellectual aura that surrounds the deep-rooted prejudices of philosophers. Whether a thing is true or false is of no importance. If it yields pleasure, it has fulfilled its reason for being. This is as true of a strumpet as of Hegel's philosophy. Pleasure, not truth, is the unit of all values. And that is the secret of the philosophy of the greatest of all thinkers of the ancient world, Epicurus. To the philosophic mind, isolation is the only miracle. Each thing is the shadow of some other thing. A thing without relations would be a monstrous apocalypse in nature, a veritable Peter Schmiel. Driven from relation to relation, he is at last forced to posit an absolute, a first cause, a something that stands unrelated to a past. Then he smiles that lifelong smile, which is nothing more than fine ironic glint from his vacuity. Express your deadly thought if you wish to extract the poison in it. Let the artist kill the thinker. Let creation, and there is a creation that is destructive, destroy the destroyer. Where is the thinker who, at the end of his life, is called encore in the face of the falling curtain? His books are his bile transfigured. He who pursues truth must be prepared to enjoy the honeymoon after he catches her. The honeymoon, I mean, of disillusion. And if there is no disillusion, you have married the wrong truth. The supremely tragic figure of all philosophic history is Nietzsche, for the thing he hated most, the ideal, fell desperately in love with his sublime soul and strangled him in its love coil. His will to power, his realism, his Dionysian passion, his optimism are the very groundwork of all ideals. He was, par excellence, the thing he spurned. He was the supreme idealist of his age, a man drunk in the impossible, a maker of idols as fragile as any that had gone before. His spleen was idealism. His superb egoism was his idealism. His mind was blasted by the love of the thing he hated. He was a mental polytheist, a real primitive of that intellectual world. He endowed his thoughts with life, conceived them to be living things. They frowned at him, laughed at him, dressed and undressed before him. He married them, unmarried him, he, the priest of mind. He coddled them, raged against them. They lived in communities like men and women. They functioned before him like us. He even speaks of their brows, their necks, their legs. Some were fleet, others slow. Some lame, others were merely slaves. They lived hierarchically. Some wore purple, other patches. They had their houses, their dung heaps, their bathtubs. They slew him in the end, as we are all slain at last by the things we give birth to.
Sing my own tale that only I can tell. Deep in my heart, deep in my mind, deep in the depths of my ego.
The third piece I will read is Anarchists, Archists, and Egoists by Sidney E. Parker.
Place me in your prison, put me in your cell, lock me up and throw away the key. I will up and wander, swim and fancy free, in this big world that's inside me.
Is conscious egoism therefore compatible with anarchism? There is no doubt that it is possible to formulate a concept of anarchism that is ostensibly egoistic. For many years, I tried to do this, and I know of several individuals who still claim to be anarchists because they are egoists. The problem, however, is that the theory of anarchism as a theory of non-domination demands that the individuals refrain from dominating others, even if they could gain greater satisfaction from dominating than from not dominating. To allow domination would be to deny anarchism. In other words, the freedom of the anarchist is yet another yoke placed around the neck of the individual in the name of yet another conceptual imperative. The question was answered at some length by Dora Marsden in two essays that appeared in her review for The Egoist of September 12, 1914, and February 1, 1915. The first was entitled The Illusion of Anarchism. The second, Some Critics Answered. Some months before the appearance of her first essay on anarchism, Marsden had been engaged in a controversy with the redoubtable Benjamin Tucker, in which she had defended what she called egoist anarchism against what she saw as the clerico-libertarianism of Tucker. At the premature end of the controversy, Tucker denounced her as an egoist and archist, to which she replied that she was quite willing to not, according to Mr. Tucker, be called an anarchist, but responded readily to egoist. In the interval between the end of the controversy and the publication of her first essay, she had evidently given considerable thought to the relation of egoism to anarchism and had decided that the latter was something in which she could no longer believe. The gist of her new position was as follows. Every form of life is archistic. An archist is one who seeks to establish, maintain, and protect, by the strongest weapons at his disposal, the law of his own interest. All growing life forms are aggressive. Aggressive is what growing means. Each fights for his own place and to enlarge it, and enlarging it is a growth. And because life forms are gregarious, there are myriads of claims to lay exclusive hold on any place. The claimants are myriad, bird, beast, plant, insect, vermin. Each will assert its sole claim to any place as long as it is permitted. As witness, the pugnacity of gnat, weed, and flea. The scant ceremony of the housewife's broom, the axe which makes a clearing, the scythe, the fisherman's net, the slaughterhouse bludgeon, all assertions of aggressive interest promptly countered by the more powerful interests. The world falls to him who can take it, if instinctive action can tell us anything. It is this aggressive territoriality that motivates domination. The living unit is an organism of embodied wants, and the want is a term which indicates an apprehension of the existence of barriers, conditions, easy or hard, which lie between the setting onwards and the arrival, i.e., the satisfaction. Thus, every want has two sides, obverse and reverse, of which the one would read the not yet dominated, and the other progressive domination. The two sides grow at the expense of each other. The coexistence of the consciousness of a lacking satisfaction with the corresponding and inevitable instinct to dominate, that which prolongs the lack, are features which characterize life. Bridging the interval between the want and its satisfaction is the exercising of the instinct to dominate, obstructing conditions. The distinction between the lifeless and the living is comprised under an inability to be other than a victim to conditions. That of which the latter can be said possesses life, that of which the former is inanimate. It is this doministic instinct to which we have applied the label archistic. Of course, this exercising of the doministic instinct does not result in every life form becoming dominant. Power being naturally unequal, the struggle for predominance usually settles down into a condition in which the less powerful end up being dominated by the more powerful. Indeed, many of the less powerful satisfy the instinct to dominate by identifying themselves with those who actually do dominate. The great lord can always count on having doorkeepers in abundance. Marsden argues that anarchists are among those who, like Christians, seek to muzzle the doministic tendency by urging us to renounce our desires to dominate. Their purpose is to make men willing to assert that, though they are born and inclined archists, they ought to be anarchists. Faced with this colossal encounter of interest, i.e. of lives, the anarchist breaks with his thus far and no further and introduces his law of inviolability of the individual liberty. The anarchist is thus a principled embargoist who sees in domination the evil of evils. It is the first article of my faith that archistic encroachments upon the free activity of men are not compatible with the respect due to the dignity of man as man. The ideal of humanity forbids the domination of one man by his fellow. This humanitarian embargo is an absolute, a procedure of which the observance is God in itself. The government of man by man is wrong. The respect of an embargo constitutes right. The irony is that in the process of seeking to establish this condition of non-domination called anarchy, the anarchist would be compelled to turn to a sanction that is but another form of domination. In the theoretical society of the anarchist, they would have to resort to an intra-individual domination of conscience in order to prevent the inter-individual domination that characterizes political government. In the end, therefore, anarchism boils down to a species of clerico-libertarianism and is the gloss covering the wishes of a unit possessed of the instinct to dominate even his fellow man. Not only this, but faced with the practical problems of achieving the free society, the anarchist fantasy would melt away before the realities of power. The state has fallen, long live the state. The furthest going revolutionary anarchist cannot get away from this. On the morrow of his successful revolution, he would need to set about finding means to protect his anarchistic notions, and would find himself protecting his own interests with all the powers he could command, like an archist, formulating his laws and maintaining his state until some franker archist arrived to displace and supersede him. Nonetheless, having abandoned anarchism, Marsden has no intention of returning to an acceptance of the authority of the state and its laws, for this would be to confuse an attitude which refused to hold laws and interests sacred, i.e., whole, unquestioned, untouched, and that which refuses to respect the existence of forces, of which laws are merely the outward visible index. It is a very general error, but the anarchist is especially the victim of it. The greater intelligence of the archist will understand that, though laws considered as sacred are foolishness, respect for any and every law is due for just the amount of retaliatory force there may be involved in it, if it be flouted. Respect for sanctity and respect for power stand at opposite poles. The respecter of the one is the verbalist, of the other, the archist, the egoist. When, therefore, Marsden writes that anarchists are not separated in any way from kinship with the devout, they belong to the Christian church and should be recognized as Christianity's picked children, she is not merely being frivolous. Anarchism as a theory of an individual society, whether communist, mutualist, or individualist, matters little in this respect. Of necessity, must demand renunciation of domination both in means and ends. That in practice it would necessitate another form of domination for its operation is a contradiction not unknown in other religions, which in no way alter their essence. The conscious egoist, in contrast, is not bound by any demand for renunciation of domination, and if it is within his competence, he will dominate others if this is in his interest. That anarchism and egoism are not equivalent is admitted, albeit unwillingly, by the well-known American anarchist John Beverly Robinson, who depicted an anarchist society in the most lachrymous terms in his Rebuilding the World, and in his succinct essay, Egoism. Throwing anarchist principles overboard, he writes of the egoist that, if the state does things that benefit him, he will support it. If it attacks him and encroaches on his liberty, he will evade it by any means in his power if he is not strong enough to withstand it. Again, if the law happens to be to his advantage, he will avail himself of it. If it invades his liberty, he will transgress it as far as he thinks it is wise to do so. But he has no regard for it as a thing supernal. Robinson thus denies the validity of the anarchist principle of non-domination, since the existence of the state and its laws necessitates the existence of a permanent apparatus of repression. If I make use of them for my advantage, then I invoke their repressive power against anyone who stands opposed to what I want. In other words, I make use of anarchistic action to gain my end. Egoism. Conscious egoism, seen for what it is not based on any fantasy, for its champions are well aware of the vital difference between if I want something, I ought to get it, and being competent to achieve what I want. The egoist lives among the realities of power in the world of archists, not among the myths of the renouncers in the dream world of anarchists. The theories of Benjamin Tucker regarding what anarchism would be like in practice, like those of the anarchist communists, are not based on any empirical evidence. This is shown in Tucker's essay, Why I Am an Anarchist. Here the reader is regaled with such claims as, no prospect can be positively alluring that does not promise both requisites of happiness, liberty, and wealth. Now, anarchism does promise both. In fact, it promises the second as the result of the first, and happiness as the result of both. Abolish the tariffs, issue no patents, take down the bars from unoccupied land, and labor will straightway rush in and take possession of its own. Then mankind will live in freedom and in comfort. Having made these rosy promises, however, Tucker has to admit that he cannot prove his case. Yet he seeks to wriggle out of the problems this poses by claiming that it cannot be dismissed by plain denial, in plain disregard of the fact that it is up to him to prove his affirmations, not for the denier to disprove them. At the bottom of Tucker's doctrine lies the democratic delusion that each and every individual, the insane excepted, can and should take an equal part in determining human affairs. He believed that everyone was potentially capable of exercising the sovereignty of the individual, and that, furthermore, their self-interest would lead them to accept his particular brand of social salvation. Despite his admiration for Max Stirner, he was a possessed man, possessed by the fixed idea that he had the answer to the social question. His egoism was pressed into the service of an ideal which neutered it. Tucker's ideological blinkers prevented him from seeing that the logic of conscious egoism bursts the straitjacket of anarchism. Finally, I am going to end with a poem by Voltairine de Cleyre. It can be found in her selected works of Voltairine de Cleyre. It is titled, You and I. You and I in the sere, brown weather, when clouds hang thick in the frowning sky, when rain tears drip on the bloomless heather, unheeding the storm blasts, we'll walk together and look to each other, you and I. You and I, when the clouds are shriven to show the cliff broods of lightnings high, when over the ramparts swift, thunder driven, rush the bolts of hate from hell lit heaven, we'll smile at each other, you and I. You and I, when the bolts are falling, the hot air torn with the earth's wild cries, we'll lean through the darkness where death is calling. We'll search through the shadows where night is palling, and find the light in each other's eyes. You and I, when black sheets of water drench and tear us and drown our breath, below this laughter of hell's own daughter, above the smoke of the storm girt slaughter, we'll hear each other and gleam at death. You and I, in the gray night dying, when over the east land the dawn beams fly, down in the groans and the low faint crying, down where the thick blood is blackly lying, we'll reach our weak arms, you and I. You and I, in the cold white weather, when over our corpses the pale lights lie, we'll rest at last from the dread endeavor, pressed to each other for parting never, our dead lips together, you and I. You and I, when the years in flowing have left us behind with all things that die, with the rot of our bones shall give soil for growing, the loves of the future made sweet for blowing by the dew of the kiss of a last goodbye.